now by someone better known as TV's Adam Pearson, but we're not going to talk about his TV work today. We're talking about his disability campaigning. We're in the midst of Disability Pride Month. What does this month mean to you, Adam?
So Disability Pride Month, it is a time and a space where I think it's important that disabled people really own who they are, own their identity, and find the time and space to unapologetically be themselves. As long as who they are is operating within the confines of the law, of course. And it's a double-edged sword for me, because whilst I think Disability Pride Month is a great tool and mechanism of raising awareness of things like disability and inclusion, I think every month should be Disability Pride Month. I'm not a big fan of demarcating times of the year to be proud of something and then saying, oh, but the other 11, forget about it, baby. So, yeah, I like it, but I think it's, for me, it's a 24/7, 365 dealio.
Most definitely. That's the thing. Like, it's all well and good having Disability Pride Month, but you have to live with your disability forever. It's not just, your disability doesn't come and go after a month, so you should be proud of it the whole time. People obviously will know you from the telly. You know, you've most recently been on Celebrity MasterChef, which you did very well at. I'm not going to say how well you did in case people haven't watched it yet. No spoiler alerts. But for people who don't know you, what is your disability and how would you describe how it impacts your body?
Cool. So I have a genetic condition called type 1 neurofibromatosis. Affects the 17th chromosome in the human genome, has a prevalency rate of one birth in every 2,300. So that puts it just within the confines of being classified as rare. The benchmark for a rare disease is one in 2,000. And the condition itself causes non-cancerous tumours called fibromas to grow on your nerve endings. So in the same way that electric cables are wrapped in plastic, our nerves are wrapped in cells called Schwann cells. And the condition means that those Schwann cells don't know when to stop growing. So as I said, it causes non-cancerous tumors to grow. Most of mine are on my face and upper torso, which has given me a facial disfigurement. And I've got like a little one on my hand. I just held my hand up to the camera on a radio interview. I should be better than that now, Chris. I should be better. I'm better trained than that, Chris. But I still did it. And that's how it affects me. But you can divide these into several different models, if you will. So you've got the medical model, which is what we leaned on quite a lot in the 60s, 70s and 80s, where we thought that disabled people were made disabled by their medical circumstances. Nothing more, nothing less. And then as we slowly became more enlightened and aware as a society, and aware, not woke, aware and woke are two very, very different things. As we became more aware as a society, we realised that if we made certain, what we call reasonable adjustments to the world around us and our environments, that disabled people could become more included and function as their non-disabled counterparts, whether it's like ramps for buildings, braille on lift buttons, larger print menus or signs at airports and stations and what have you. It was less the medicine and more of an access thing that were preventing disabled people from partaking in society, be it either socially or economically.
So for people that don't know, you didn't always have this facial disfigurement, did you? When did that come about? And when it first started happening and your face started changing, how did it make you feel initially, you know, having people looking at you and things like that?
So, yeah, whilst I always had the condition, it didn't start developing until I was about 5 years old. You have the condition itself, the genotype, And then you have what we call the phenotype, which is the way the your genes choose to present themselves. And so for me, it all started kicking off when I was about 5 years old. We went through a lot of rigmarole, got a diagnosis eventually. And the diagnostics wasn't what it was now, back in the 90s. So our experience of diagnostics was a very cocky doctor reading a definition of a medical textbook, patting one more on the hand and wishing her good luck. And then you start going through the hospital side of things. I spent a lot of time as a kid in hospital waiting rooms or surgeries and what have you. And I suppose this may sound incredibly blasé, but I was too young to notice it all. Because it all happened so young, I've grown up knowing no different. So I didn't have that sort of transition that other people would have had to acquiring a disfigurement or a disability, because 80% of disabilities are acquired at working age, i.e. 18 to 65. But I didn't really have that because it all happened so young. And I've always been a put your head down and crack on with it kind of guy, like no excuses, no apologies. And it sounds really cliche to say now, because that Hugh Jackman musical movie. But even as a kid, I was always like, this is me, this is who I am, like it or lump it. Those aren't the actual lyrics for the song I'm joking about, but the impetus is very much the same. And yeah, I know that's like a real nothing answer to what is a really important question.
Well, this is the thing as well, because you weren't the... Your brother's disabled as well, isn't he? So you did you kind of find a lot of support in each other?
Well, we're twins, so we've got the same condition, but it presents itself differently. And Neil's symptoms didn't start presenting until he was about 14. But I think there's a lot to be said for twins are already quite close. My best friend, Roxy, is a twin. And girl twins are very different from guy twins. Girl twins tend to do everything together and hang out a lot. Guy twins are very competitive, don't like each other that much, until the chips are down on the table. And then when stuff has to happen, you sort of like step in and then you're close. It's a very different kind of psychology and camaraderie. But he's a good kid. I like him.
That's good. It's always good when you like your brother, isn't it? What would you say to people that perhaps, because I'm sure you still get it, people that stop and stare and wonder what's gone on with you. I mean, when you last visited me and Kai when in Lincoln, you know, you went round and you just walked around so confidently and, you know, people probably would stop and stare, but it just didn't seem to affect you. But what would you say to them? Would you say, come ask me about it, find out what it's about, or...
Well, yeah, no, come talk to me, come ask. I've got no problem answering questions. I think that's a way more productive thing than everyone else sitting there playing sort of like House MD or Grey's Anatomy in their own head. But also, that's just my way of dealing with it. And if you've met a disabled person, you've met a disabled person, congratulations. Every person will have a different disability and they'll be navigating that disability in a very different way. And we'll be at a different point in their disability journey. But I'm all about no holds barred conversations, because that's the only way anyone learns anything. And it's a lot more productive to my mind than sitting in a vow of fake acceptance and noble silence. And that's how I tend to deal with things. You say I walked around like very confidently, thank you very much. I gather we had been on the lash that evening.
Probably.
There were other factors that played into that other than my own confidence.
Yes. Do you think that there's enough education around disability? Like, as a disability campaigner, do you think like schools are doing enough and people are doing enough to show that actually having a disability isn't anything bad?
And I do think there is a problem with the word disability, that it somehow, I don't know who made it a dirty word, but it is a dirty word. And so when I go and do like corporate training or school assemblies or any of that malarkey. The first thing I do is get people just used to saying the word. Just be like, come on, after three, one, two, three, I'll say it with you. Disability, no one died. Amazing. Now we can all say the word. We can finally talk about it.
Yeah.
And that's step one. And then step two is how to incorporate it into an education system without making it a thing. I think once you pull something out as a subject matter, you've instantly made it other or different. So how do we interweave it into what we're already learning about and already talking about? And because that's the only way we're gonna normalize it. And I think it's a real challenge to do it and do it well. And it's something that I've really thought about as I've grown older, wiser, and more astute in the area. And I'm very fortunate now where I'm at the point of my career where I can now just go on the telly and not have to talk about disability. I can now go on a quiz show and get voted out by a comedian when I wasn't the weakest link. He knows who he is. He knows who he is.
Or be terrible at Pointless.
I was amazing at Pointless, Chris Stockton. How dare you? It was Chris Hollins who was terrible. I need better friends, don't I? You and Kai have been nothing but rotten to me since Pointless.
Well, I'm still waiting for you to announce that you're going to be doing Strictly, Adam.
And that is the one thing that I could do that would make my mother finally respect me as a man.
I'm really surprised they've not asked you.
She loves me because she's my mum, but she's questioned my career choices since day dot. Like, when I told her I was going on MasterChef, her exact words were, oh dear.
So we've kind of veered a little bit into TV here. So one thing I do want to ask you, and I know we said we weren't going to talk much about TV, but what is your opinion around whether disabled people are accepted within the industry? Is it getting better? Is it improving? Is there still a lot of work to do surrounding it?
At the moment, and this is purely statistically, all the diversity reports for the various channels were published really recently. And the numbers are either staying the same or going down. And I think that needs addressing at both an on-screen and off-screen level. And I don't know how to do it, because I've been having the same conversations with the same channels and the same execs about a decade now. And I'm at the point now whenever they email me to be on a panel, I'm like, no, you know what I think. You know what to do.
Mm.
How about we all just stop sitting on panels and crack on with it and start doing it?
But this is the thing, you know, I think you'd be great if you had a talk show on telly, you know, where you could, you know, highlight and showcase people with disability. And, you know, I just think it would be... It's something great that, you know, we don't see enough of. And like you say, there's endless panel shows on telly, endless comedy shows. There's so much going on, but you don't see that diversity within the programming.
Well, no, but that has gotten slowly better. I think it took them 20 years to get a disabled comedian on Have I Got News For You.
Yeah.
That took a while. I think it took 18 seasons to get a disabled person on I'm a Celebrity, Get Me Out of Here. And I just don't understand, A, why it takes so long, and B, what the resistance is.
Yeah.
I mean, me and some friends from a very successful disability podcast. We would get amazing, interesting, talented disabled people on all the time. Like, we've interviewed Eva Avery, who was the young comedian from Britain's Got Talent. We've got Lost Voice Guy coming on at some point in the not-too-distant future. We've had Paralympic rugby gold medalist Aaron Fitt on. We've got the fashion designer and blogger Victoria Jenkins coming on soon. Our editor is a very well-known disabled MVE, Isaac Harvey. Like, the talent is out there. And you've just got to be bothered to look for it. You've got to pull your socks up and do your job. And stop boiling the word diversity. Because I think this is another bugbear I have. Sorry, I'm on a rant now, Chris. I apologise.
It's fine.
We said we weren't going to do this yet. Here we are. Often when people say diversity, what they mean is black and woman. And I always say, if you're not doing disability, you're not doing diversity. All you're doing is box ticking.
Yeah. And I think it's something that I feel, and you've worked for Channel 4, so you know, you'll be able to tell me this, but I get the impression that they're the ones that do kind of book the trend. I mean, you know, they had the Undateables, they have The Last Leg, you know, which is presented by Adam Hills, who's disabled. You know, they seem to be doing a lot more of it than what a lot of the other TV stations do.
I really like Channel 4's approach to disability, because they do it significantly more. I think qualitatively, their output is better in terms of disability, and they also do it in a very controversial and confrontational way, which isn't for everyone, and I understand that. But it's something, and you know me, Chris, it's something I greatly appreciate.
Yeah.
I love a little bit of controversy. I love a title that gets people's backs up a little bit and gets people talking. Like, ahead of time, we've got Rosie Jones's documentary coming up really, really soon that caused a lot of uproar. But is there such a thing as bad publicity?
No. So you mentioned your podcast there. If people want to listen to that, where can they go to do that? Where can they find it?
So you can find us on our YouTube channel, The Grumpy Gits, and we are Grumpy Gits Show on both Twitter and Instagram.
So it's only available on YouTube, yeah?
Currently, yes. We are setting up an audio feed as we speak.
Wonderful. Thank you very much for your time, as ever, Adam. And if Strictly do come calling, please make the first interview on Siren to announce it.
I will do. That'll certainly annoy Spark and the BBC, but I'll make the announcement on Siren.
Okie doke. Thank you very much.